This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The more you learn about germs, the more impossible it seems to combat them. According to Dr. Charles Gerba, it's actually better to be sneezed on than to shake someone's hand, because we pick up infections all the time just by touching surfaces and bringing our fingers to our nose or eyes. Germs are Dr. Gerba's territory. He's a professor of environmental microbiology at the University of Arizona and a leading authority on the microbial transmission of disease. Most of his germ sleuthing takes place in people's homes, in their kitchens and bathrooms, as well as in public bathrooms in hotels, restaurants, and offices. I asked Charles Gerba what the most microbial room is in the average home.
Well, actually, the most germ-laden room in the house is actually the kitchen. If you ask most people, they would actually say the bathroom, but and it's actually reversed. The kitchen is your most germ-laden area in the whole home.
And how do you analyze this? How do you go about figuring that out?
Well, we've actually gone into a lot of homes and checked them out microbially. Actually, until a few years ago, we knew more about the microbiology of the moon than your home. So a few people have actually really studied it in this country. And what we've actually discovered, there's more germs that could potentially make you ill in your kitchen sink than actually in your toilet. Actually, it's probably safer to make a sandwich on a toilet seat than actually your kitchen sink, from what we found out. And the reason why probably is because most people use disinfectant cleaners in the bathroom area. They use disinfectant sprays and various types of cleaning solutions that have disinfectants. And they don't realize how important that is actually in the kitchen area too, because you're always bringing in potentially microorganisms that could make you ill on your poultry products, just an example, salmonella, or on your raw meat products. And they can get onto various surfaces in your kitchen area and actually grow to very large numbers.
Reading your research, I wanted to immediately burn all my sponges. Sponges seem to be real hot spots.
Yeah, actually, the sponge is the most germ-laden area of the whole home, we found out. The reason why is because it's always moist, bugs like that, and also you're always bringing food to them. You're wiping up surfaces and picking up food particles and all time, and the bacteria just love that. I mean, the best home a germ ever had was a kitchen sponge. And overnight, particularly if you leave it on the counter, they grow to billions overnight. And every time you wipe a surface, you're actually spreading these all around the kitchen. And in our studies, what we found, some of the cleanest people are actually the dirtiest when it comes to germs, because they're just spreading them all around all the time. Every time they wipe a surface, they lay down a nice layer of germs that potentially could make you ill without really realizing it.
Now, cross-contamination seems to be the worst enemy. Why don't you tell us what it is, and then take us through proper food handling, starting with unloading the groceries.
Yeah, probably the first thing to do is to make sure none of the raw meat products have opened up or you get any juices on your hand, because that's always a sign you should wash your hands right away. You don't want to pick up a broken package of poultry, for example, put it in the refrigerator, and then put the raw vegetables away, like your lettuce, head of lettuce, your tomatoes, and that, because then you contaminated them potentially with salmonella. 30% or more of the poultry in this country contains salmonella on it. Now, when you cook that food, you're going to destroy the salmonella, but usually we eat vegetables, make salads out of them, eat them raw, and that's where the cross-contamination occurs. Other problems happen, like with the sponges. When you wipe up an area, you can spread salmonella, for example, which you're then going to put raw food products on there, and then get it on your hands. Now, you get it on your hands, and you can make a salad or other types of food which you might eat raw, but also you may bring your fingers to your nose or mouth. This is particularly important in a small child. A small child brings his fingers to his nose and mouth hundreds of times a day, almost once every 3 minutes. In fact, he touches and swallows the dirt on the equivalent of about 6 to 8 kitchen floor tiles every day. And if there were salmonella or other bacteria on there, he's putting them right where they want to be. I mean, we literally pick up germs every day when we move through the kitchen. If there happens to be one there that can make us ill, then we create a situation where basically we can transmit the germ to ourselves. Now, another common mistake people make is cutting boards. They'll cut up their raw meat products or make a hamburger on it, and then they'll put it in the oven, which destroys the bacteria that could make you ill. And then typically all they do is rinse off that cutting board. And that doesn't get rid of the germs that could make you ill. And you have to really disinfect that cutting board with a disinfectant cleaner or common household bleach, for example.
And how do you clean your kitchen table well?
I think the best thing for germ warfare in the kitchen area is to do several things. One, get germ-resistant sponges. Use disinfected cleaners for the kitchen area, or just use a common household bleach on those areas when you clean and wipe areas. Nowadays, they make disinfected cleaners specially made for the kitchen area because most manufacturers realize the main battleground in germ warfare in the home is the kitchen. So use disinfectant cleaners is the real key here. Also use paper towels when you can to wipe up major spills, particularly juices from meat products, and then throw those germs away right into the garbage can.
How long do germs survive on surfaces?
Well, they can survive for hours or even days. In fact, they can even grow in your kitchen sink area where it's nice and moist.
And you're talking about E. coli or rotavirus, which is all over the place. That can live for hours and days?
Oh, yeah, even days on surfaces, particularly. Viruses can survive for a matter of days, ones that cause like rotavirus, which cause diarrhea, for example. In the kitchen area, the main concern is bacteria because they can regrow in your food, and you're always bringing them in on your raw poultry products. That's why you really actually have more fecal bacteria in your kitchen sink oftentimes than you do in your toilet for that reason.
Now, most of us are not that anal about cleaning our kitchen or don't even know about some of the stuff that you're talking about, yet we seem to be healthy.
Well, two things. I think I should point out that cleanliness in the kitchen is really just using the right cleaning tools and right cleaning products. Use germ-resistant products and use disinfectant cleaners. It's really no more work. The other thing is most people don't realize when they actually get ill. Almost everybody has had the 24, 48-hour flu. Well, most of the time, that's really foodborne poisoning that they're actually getting, and they don't really associate it with mishandling in the kitchen area. In fact, we believe that 50 to 80% of all foodborne illness originate in the home. It's actually safer to eat out than in the home. So next time your neighbor invites you over, I'd suggest you take them out to dinner rather than eating over there. That's because most people don't recognize and realize the problem and where they're getting a lot of these illnesses. Foodborne illness costs this country over $23 billion a year, for example. So it is a significant problem. And we do miss a lot of days of work and inconvenience because of illnesses we can acquire from mishandling food in the kitchen area.
There was a recent recall of hamburger from Hudson Foods because of E. coli contamination. Now, that company didn't sound unusually negligent. In fact, it was a new plant and was rumored to be one of the better run outfits. What lesson did you draw from the Hudson Foods hamburger debacle?
I think what we've learned is we got to be really more cautious because I think one of the problems we're producing meat products on a larger scale than ever before. And if a small error occurs now, large amounts of meat products can be contaminated. Where years ago, 100 years ago, you wanted a chicken, you went out in the backyard and grabbed it around its neck and you made it for dinner. And if it had salmonella, only you and your family got ill. Well, today, if that chicken has salmonella or that cow has E. coli 0157, you ground it in with hundreds or millions of pounds of hamburger, it can contaminate a lot more hamburger and a lot more people that are exposed than ever before.
The World Health Organization endorses irradiation of food to prevent these bacterial outbreaks. What are the pros and cons of irradiation?
Well, actually, irradiation of foods has been studied for more than 30 years, and it's really a quite safe process. I think it's just always a concern of using radiation always bothers the consumer, and that's why you haven't really seen it at a large scale in this country, although it's used in other countries in the world. It's really perfectly safe to utilize. Unfortunately, sometimes doses may be higher than you like, and it may cause off-flavoring of the food.
Let's talk about hand washing. I think we all know now it's good to wash our hands. We should do it more, but apparently we don't do it right.
No, one, we don't do it right. That's probably the best defense in germ warfare you can use is washing your hands because you literally pick up germs all the time and you bring your fingers to your nose and your mouth many, many times, hundreds of times for small children a day. So that is your best chance. You can never wash your hands enough, according to some people. Unfortunately, many people, when they go to the bathroom, don't wash their hands, and they can literally transfer these germs to various locations. And I think not only going to the bathroom, but any person making a meal should always wash their hands before they start the meal and after they handle any raw meat products. The best way to wash your hands is really to scrub it for at least 30 seconds, remembering to point your hands down into the sink so any drops go down in the sink and they don't run onto your wrist, and wash in between the fingers. That's really critical for that, and even the nails. That's the best hand washing procedure that you can use.
There's so many antibacterial soaps out there on the market. Are they really effective?
Well, they are effective against certain types of bacteria that can cause foodborne illness and skin infections. But generally, you can just wash your hands long enough and you can achieve the same job. Just remembering to wash your hands for at least 30 seconds to a minute, and you can do a really good job. But they can help certain people with dermatitis and remove certain types of microorganisms over time. Particularly some of the newer soaps and that leave a residual on your hands. So you have some residual effect for certain types of bacteria.
Is it possible that we'd overuse these antibacterial soaps and create the same kind of situation we've created with the overuse of antibiotics, that we'd create resistant strains of bacteria by using all this stuff?
That's a good question. But no, the answer is no. We've been using chlorine, for example, which is common household bleach, for more than 100 years, and we have no evidence that any microorganism has developed any resistance. Disinfectants are much different than antibiotics. Disinfectants are like using a stick of dynamite to blow up a cockroach. It really just whacks the organism so heavily from so many different directions that it really doesn't have a chance to develop any type of resistance. And there's really no evidence of that. You use more household bleach in your swimming pool in a year than you would use in a lifetime in your kitchen. And we've never seen any type of organism really develop any resistance to disinfectants. In fact, proper use of household disinfectants will actually save on the use of antibiotics, because you will have to use less antibiotics if you actually do get ill.
Now, you've also spent a lot of time investigating public restrooms. What have you found? Who has the unhealthier bathrooms, men or women?
Well, definitely women went up by a long shot. Women, you can find more bacteria that can potentially make you ill in a woman's restroom than you can in a man. I mean, it's really keeping me out of women's restrooms the rest of my life from what I found out. Why? That's a good question. We really don't know. Perhaps women bring more children into the restroom or may have less sanitary habits, or maybe women use the restrooms much more than men. I really don't know for certain. We do know women certainly use more toilet paper than men, twice as much. Actually, American women use twice the amount of toilet paper as English women. American women are the biggest wipers in the world from what we can figure out. There are certain areas or hot spots in the public restrooms, too. These tend to be the sanitary napkin disposal, the bottom of the toilet seats, the sinks, sink handles, and the floor. Those are the most germ-laden areas. In our studies, we could isolate the salmonella bacteria in almost 6% of the sinks in women's restrooms.
Well, Charles, you shouldn't be in women's bathrooms anyway. when you're analyzing them, have you ever gotten in a little trouble?
Well, in the men's room, yes, I've had the police call me on twice. Not many people try to take water samples out of toilets. So I have had the police called on me a couple of times when we were doing that work. Actually, the cleanest restrooms tend to be restrooms in hospitals, particularly public restrooms in hospitals. The worst restrooms are gas stations, as you might guess. I'm surprised a new life form has never evolved in a toilet in a gas station, and then bus stations and airports. Generally, if there's only one stall, they tend to be the most heavily contaminated, and then having more stalls tend to help. If you have a lot of stalls, tend to use the first stall, because fewest people tend to use the first stall, and there's always a greater chance of finding more toilet paper there, too.
Charles Gerba is my guest. He's a professor of microbiology at the University of Arizona. We're talking about germs, microbes, and food contamination. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with environmental microbiologist Charles Gerba. You've also been called in as a consultant for the space program. What was their problem?
Well, usually one of the biggest problems in space is really, if you're going to have a space station or colonies on the moon, is how rapidly you can circulate your waste material, particularly urine and wash water from taking showers and that. You don't have a lot of space in space to store urine and water before you have to recirculate it back to drinking water. So you want to do it as quick as possible. One of the things you got to learn to do is to take that water and turn it back into drinking water really fast, like in 24 hours, and make it not taste like wastewater. I guess that's the other thing you have to do. You certainly don't want to let any waste go out in the outer space, because it's traveling at a very high speed, and you don't want to meet up with it again.
How do you do that?
You keep it. urine and wash water, you circulate very rapidly back. But in terms of fecal material, you save it or find something that, with it to grow.
And is that what you did? You found something?
Oh, what we're actually evaluating, what we've looked at is how well you can take shower water and treat it and remove all the bacteria and pathogens that could potentially make you ill, and then reuse it as drinking water or hygiene water, like washing your hands or taking another shower.
And have you solved that?
Well, NASA does the problems on that, and they apparently have solved it. We've tested a lot of samples for them, and they seem to be able to do that. I don't necessarily recommend the same procedure at home.
Now, how safe is our drinking water?
Well, that's a good question. Several years ago, we felt it was reasonably safe. But advances in our ability to detect pathogens and more awareness of disease-causing organisms indicated that we do have major problems from waterborne parasites, particularly one called Cryptosporidium. Back in the early 90s, we had a large waterborne outbreak from Cryptosporidium in Milwaukee, where over 400 individuals developed diarrhea and more than 100 died. And this was a well-operated water treatment plant with the technology we currently believe would eliminate all waterborne disease in the United States. And since that time, we've had numerous waterborne outbreaks from Cryptosporidium, and they have also occurred in the United Kingdom, for example. Cryptosporidium is a parasite that's unusually resistant to disinfectants. In fact, you can't normally kill it with disinfectants as they're usually applied to drinking water. It's so resistant, we have to depend on filtration. And if there are large numbers of this organism in the raw water, we can't effectively remove it. Studies have indicated that maybe 20 to 30% of our finished drinking water in the United States have low levels of Cryptosporidium in it. Now, that doesn't mean you're always going to have an outbreak from Cryptosporidium, but these low levels may cause random cases of illness in the community, may go unrecognized as waterborne illness. So I believe we do have a concern there with drinking water in the United States that needs to be looked at to see if we can deal with it. How important a problem is it? What do low levels of a parasite like Cryptosporidium mean in our drinking water? And also, the question arises, do we need better treatment processes for removing Cryptosporidium when we have large amounts in our raw drinking water supply?
Do you drink tap water?
Yes, I do, but I do have a filter device on it because I think it's only wise maybe to just be extra sure on that. But I think there are a lot of things we don't know about our drinking water with microorganisms that we do. I think there's been really too much concern about chemicals in drinking water. When we really look at the risk of you potentially getting ill, microorganisms are much more of a concern. In the area of groundwater, viruses are more of a problem. We have about half the waterborne disease outbreaks that occur in the United States every year are due to contaminated groundwater. And that's because the viruses are so small they can get into the soil and into your groundwater. And recent studies have indicated nationwide studies on virus in groundwater that it may be a fairly frequent occurrence in some areas of the country where they have hard bedrock, which allows for fractures where viruses can migrate long distances.
People with compromised immune systems, that's elderly people or people undergoing radiation treatments or HIV positive, they're advised to drink bottled water or use water purification devices because of this. Let's start with the bottled water. How do you know bottled water isn't just tap water with a fancy label?
Well, nowadays you really don't know on that, and you don't really know how thoroughly it's been tested either. It has to meet, though, EPA requirements for drinking water, so you can be assured that it's at least as safe as your drinking water. And usually most manufacturers add additional treatments such as filtration and ozone to be extra sure that organisms like Cryptosporidium or other organisms that can affect immunocompromised are actually killed. So there is some extra assurance. If you can read on the label that it's been ozone and filtered, that it's probably additionally treated to give you better assurance. But there really is no criteria right now for testing and assuring that these organisms have been destroyed in bottled water or other types of treated water.
What drew you to germs?
That's a good question. Actually, I read a book one time called The Microbe Hunters by Paul D. Kerf, where it was about famous microbiologists and how they were faced with all these detective stories of how to figure out how to control germs, where they originated, and what was causing the illnesses. Actually, most microbiologists in the public health area are really detectives all the time. What I study is how really germs are transmitted from one person to the other. How do they actually get there? How do they get through the environment? So it's always a fascinating detective story, particularly anytime you get a waterborne outbreak and you get to help and investigate it. You have to act very rapidly. You have to come in there and try to use your wits to figure out where to sample, where the organisms might be, what organism might it be when it hasn't maybe yet even been identified yet.
Now, you have children. How do you manage to raise them without making them insane.
Oh, well, I named my first one after a bacteria, Escherichia. So I think I got them adapted to a microbiologist as a father right away. Actually, they've been involved in my research throughout my career. In the early days, I used to save their stool and bring it into work all the time because I needed the samples for my research, particularly when you couldn't grow rotavirus in the laboratory originally. You had to get it from children's stools, and I knew exactly what age group they would start getting rotavirus diarrhea, so I used to always collect their stools. Unfortunately, they used to see me take their underwear and diapers and put them in the refrigerator, freezer all the time. So as they got older, they started throwing their clothes in there, too. I had to break them of that habit, too. But I also was able to involve them in a lot of the research where we would go and study the occurrence of disease-causing organisms in rivers and lakes and that. We always seemed to make a vacation around some type of an adventure of looking for a microorganism in a river or a lake or a water supply or a food supply.
Charles Gerba, it's been a lot of fun and scary to talk to you today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Charles Gerba is an environmental microbiologist based at the University of Arizona.